lawfully satisfying sexual instinct will be struggled by its lawful way. Then, in this very surah, some of the rules of etiquette and principles of training offspring concerning parents are mentioned, stating that there are some times when husband and wife may want to be alone and isolated, so that issues must not enter their rooms without permission, for offspring may deviate intellectually thereby. For this end, it states some other rules of family life, though the sexual matters. And some of the discussions that are about monotheism, resignation to the commandment of Prophet ﷺ, discussions, because what support practical and ethical programs are the eternal issues, the belief in origin, resurrection, and a right of prophecy. And there will be flower and fruit if such a root does not exist. And meanwhile, in connection with discussions about faith and righteous deed, the establishment of the worldly government by the believers is stated, and some of the other Islam commandments are brought up. On the whole, this surah forms a comprehensive collection of Islamic thoughts and virtues. We'll start our discussion of the commentary points of this very surah in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parham. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam, Al-Hujjah, Ajalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you, as we gather to commemorate the Istishhad anniversary of our 6th Imam, Imam Ja'far As-Sadiq, Alayhima Afdalu Salatu Wassalam. Ma salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum. We pray to Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala that we each get an opportunity to go for the ziyarat of our Imam to Baqi, inshaAllah, and that we receive his shafaat in the hereafter. We are gathered to to remember and benefit from the beautiful legacy of our sixth Imam alayhi salam, and as well lament at his untimely assassination by the Abbasid government. Our Imam alayhi salam, as we know, shares the birth date of our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. On the 17th of Rabiul Awal in the year 83 after Hijrah, and his imamate began in the year 114 after Hijrah. And it's lasted for a period of 34 years. These 34 years we've talked about previously, but I think these type of biodata information is really important, you know. That the 34 years of imamate were generally split in two. Half, or a little bit more than half, was under the governorship or the caliphate of the Umayyad, but it was during the fall of the Umayyad dynasty, where in a span of 17 years, you had five different caliphs who came because, again, there was chaos. And then it coincided with the next 15 or 16 years of the Abbasid rule, which then took on many decades after that. And the Abbasid rule, the Imam alayhi salam had to deal with Al-Mansur al-Dawaniqi, who eventually poisoned the Imam alayhi salam. But this opportunity that the Imam presented is something that we've talked about in the past, is that it opened a door for him to leave a legacy and to have an imprint in society to that extent that, you know, we proudly have labeled ourselves as Ja'fari today. You know, it's from the ihsan of our sixth Imam, who showed us that at a time, you know, when there were so many different groups and so many different ideologies, he showed us the path of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. And we are grateful for that. You know, we are grateful for that, and we owe him our adoration. And more so than that, we owe him our obedience, you know, in following the teachings that he has given us and that he has provided for us. And the legacy of the Imam, the treasure trove that the Imam alayhi salam has left us is wide. It's literally wide. You know, if you open up any book of hadith, the majority hadith that we have comes from our fifth and our sixth Imams. You know, there is this, any hadith book, I have this really huge volume set called Kalima. Yeah, it has the words of Kalimatullah, Kalimatul Rasul. It's a really good book, yeah, but it's in Arabic. But it's 26 volumes, and four of these volumes, and each one is by for different Imam, but four volumes are of the sixth Imam. Just that's how much we have, and that's not even the extent of it, but that's the legacy that we have. And so what I like to do is I like to look at these traditions time to time to try to see, okay, the purpose and the goal of the Imam was to make my life better and to make my faith stronger and allow me to know what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala expects. And this is how the Imam alayhi salam grew adoration from the people. But this was also how the Abbasid caliphate began to detest the Imam, because they saw that the people were gravitating towards the Imam, and so they found that they had to find ways of sidelining them. And it is this Mansur al-Dawaniqi who viewed the Imam alayhi salam as a threat to his government. And history tells us that in numerous occasions he sent poison towards the Imam alayhi salam or tried to assassinate him. But it was in this final moment that on the 25th of Shawwal, the Imam ingested poisoned grapes and eventually his life came to an end. But you know, my brothers and sisters, there's one more event that happened prior to this. It is said Mansur sent a servant by the name of Muhammad bin Sulaiman, and he told him to go to Medina and burn down the house of the Imam. It is said this mal'oon came and he put dried wood around the house of the Imam, and then he set it ablaze. It is said the Imam alayhi salam came out. He brought his family out. They began to extinguish the fire, and he would cry out, "Ana ibn Muhammadin al-Mustafa, ana ibn Ali al-Murtada, ana ibn Fatima al-Zahra." He says, "I am the grandson of Rasulullah. Why do you do this?" It is said that after the fire was put out for days, when the companions would come to see the Imam, he would see the Imam crying. He says to the Imam, the companions would say that this is a physical gift, why do you cry? Another one may ask the Imam alayhi salam that this was not the first time your house has been set on fire. For these mal'uneen have set the house of Zahra on fire prior to that. The Imam alayhi salam says, look, I understand what you are saying to me, that this is a material existence, that this was not the first time. We have faced brutality for a long time. But he said that when this fire took over my house, I looked at the women and children of my house and how they were running from one location to another. And we were able to bring them to safety. But in that moment, I thought of my aunt Zainab in Karbala. That when they began to burn down the tents in Karbala, Zainab's hijab had been looted already. There were no males who were there to assist them except for Imam Sajjad, who was ill. It is at this time that Zainab would look at Sajjad and says, my son, what should we do? And they came out of these tents. This is the brutality of the Imam that he endured in his life. When the poison spread through his entire body, the Imam called his family and gave him his last will. And then the Imam faced the Qibla and he stretched his arms and his legs. Sweat beads began to appear on his forehead. The Imam took his last breath. Rahimallahu man nada wa imama. The Imam has left this world. The children of the Imam gathered and cried at the janazah of their father. فَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّمٌ قَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ
كَيْفَ لَا يَرْقُونَ مِصْبَاحَ الْهُدَى وَهُوَ شَمْسٌ نُورُهَا طُولَ الْمَدَى صَادِقُ الْأَقْوَالِ دَارُهُ السُّعَدَى
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the role of the Iranian parliament in Iran's foreign policy with the spokesperson for the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of the Iranian parliament, Dr. Abulfazl Amoui. But first, this brief analysis.
According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the legislative branch, called the Islamic Shura Majlis, plays an important role in foreign policy and has to ratify any treaty or agreement that creates any obligations or expenditures for Iran. In this context, the Majlis has a supervisory role over the executive branch ministries involved in foreign affairs, particularly the Foreign Ministry, which is legally obligated to report regularly about its activities to the Majlis. Like all executive branch cabinet ministers, the Minister of Foreign Affairs has to be confirmed by the Majlis before taking office, and can be removed by the Majlis if deemed not to be performing up to standard. The Majlis also has its own mechanisms of parliamentary diplomacy, a prominent example being the many bilateral parliamentary friendship groups it maintains with other legislative bodies from around the world, as well as diplomacy related to the Islamic and Asian parliamentary unions. As the historic example of the JCPOA and the current examples of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as Iran's likely future accession to the BRICS Plus shows, no international agreement is deemed legal under Iranian law until it's confirmed and ratified by the Majlis. This is in contrast to the rubber-stamp parliament that existed during the Pahlavi dynasty, which, despite some members objecting, could not even prevent the British from forcing the ruling monarch of the time to concede any claims to Bahrain during the British retreat from the Persian Gulf in 1971. Bahrain historically being Iranian territory occupied by the British when they entered the Persian Gulf in the early 19th century. Contrary to the distorted picture painted by Iran's enemies, the legislative branch, as the direct representative of a cross-section of Iranian society from all ethnic and regional backgrounds, plays an integral part in the foreign policy decision-making of Iran, and is in fact one of the greatest sources of power and credibility for the Islamic Republic in its defense of Iran's national interests and projective power around the world, together with the executive branch, the security services, and the Supreme National Security Council. As the global order is rapidly creating new constellations and new alliances, the Islamic Shura Majlis will continue to supervise the activities of the executive branch and defend Iran's national interests, as is determined under the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, and will be a source of political power for Iran on the international scene.
Dr. Abulfaz Amoei, spokesperson for the National Security Committee of the Iranian Parliament. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight today. We've come to the Majlis here to speak with you about the role of the Parliament, of the Iranian Parliament, of the Majlis in Iranian foreign policy. As you know, and as our viewers have seen, we have done a series of programs with the different members of the foreign policy team as it relates to the foreign ministry. Today we thought it might be good to look at these issues from the perspective of the parliament. So we were talking a little bit about the examples. We mentioned the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS, the issues related to the dollar. But we also were also referencing very briefly the issue of the JCPOA and the ongoing nuclear talks. I don't know if we can even call it the JCPOA anymore. Whatever it is, whatever you want to call it. And we had this very interesting thing that was mentioned in this process by the foreign minister, saying that there's a limited time that this can go on like this, the way it's been going, and the Americans not really responding in any reasonable way or in any kind of effective way to the efforts that are being made by Iran to come to an agreement. If you could please first give us a little bit of that historic background of how the Majlis was involved in the JCPOA process when it was ratified by the parliament. Later on, we saw again with the law that related to the nuclear capabilities of the country, the Majlis entering the scene, telling the government that it has to defend Iran's nuclear rights, but within the JCPOA. And now, finally, we've come to this point where it seems to be that these talks are not really getting anywhere. So if you could please give us, from the perspective of the Majlis, a little insight into this issue.
خب موضوع برجام و توافق سال 2015
Well, the issue of the JCPOA and the 2015 nuclear deal is an issue related to the previous parliament. It has been examined in the previous parliament. At the time, when a deal was reached between our government and the P5 Plus One group. This agreement is in the form of a joint program. In fact, it is not an international agreement. It is not a treaty. But it is done as a joint program between the parties. But because it could create commitments for our country, the parliament got involved in it, established a special commission, had special and complex meetings for it, and finally the previous parliament approved a law. It allowed the government with 9 conditions to carry out this joint program by pursuing Iran's national interests and take its implementation steps. Of course, other conditions were added by the leader of the Islamic Republic, and they were very important conditions, and thus the JCPOA was approved by the Iranian parliament for implementation. During the implementation of the JCPOA, from the very beginning, we witnessed the other parties' breaches. They violated their own commitments, whether in the Obama era or even more so in the Trump era. This was from the American side. Finally, Trump withdrew from this agreement in 2018 and dealt a blow to the implementation of the deal. And not only did he return the previous sanctions, but during the previous period when Trump was in power, he added maybe twice as many sanctions on Iran. And apart from the fact that the U.S. government itself did not fulfill its obligations, it prevented others who were members of the agreement from implementing their obligations, and so they too started violating them. The European side entered into a dialogue with us in 2018 and announced that we can follow up on this commitment in the form of the 4+1 without America. And again, the negotiations that took place between Iran and Europe, the European side gave us 11 commitments, which the introduction of implementing them was establishing an institution called INSTEX, which can be a financial settlement institution between Iran and Europe. But we witnessed that they delayed both in implementing this structure, and ultimately it was inefficient until they announced in recent days that they will dissolve this institution. And consequently, the 11 commitments which the Europeans gave were not implemented either. Concurrently, we witnessed the change of the parliament in Iran. The 11th parliament came, and it had a different political view than the previous one. And at the beginning of its work, due to the sensitivity of the nuclear issue, this parliament introduced a roadmap in the form of a law, and that law is a well-known law called the Strategic Action Plan to Lift Sanctions. The parliament designed a path and that the government should move in that direction. The key point was that the parliament announced in this framework that since the other party has not fulfilled its commitments, Iran should also stop the voluntary implementation of its commitments. Part of it was that we removed restrictions on the enrichment process and the enriched uranium stockpile in the parliament's law. Likewise, we said in a few months that if the other side does not take a step to lift the sanctions, Iran should no longer accept extra safeguard inspections, and the government institutions are not allowed to implement them. In fact, according to this law, the parliament took back part of the permits the previous parliament had given to the government to fulfill its obligations. And accordingly, surveillance beyond safeguards is against the law in Iran, and this is being followed up by our government. At the same time, the parliament followed the government to discuss the nuclear negotiations in order to pursue the rights of the Iranian people. We had unilaterally fulfilled our obligations based on 15 reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. But it was the other side that had violated these commitments. And today, after a long period of time, the parliament came to the conclusion that it should not accept a commitment unilaterally, and this is of no use. And this strategic action plan is still our roadmap in the 11th legislature. And that is why, during the nuclear negotiations that took place in Vienna, or whatever stage it reaches, the parliament invites the negotiating team or the foreign minister, hears the report of that meeting, and gives its opinion. That is, it follows up in the National Security Commission. Or regarding the cooperation between Iran and the agency on the surveillance issue, we have this meeting with the head of the Atomic Energy Organization and his deputies, and we will talk about what agreements they have made. We hear the details of it. We listen to their expert opinions. and at the same time, we follow up on its compliance with laws and the opinions of the Parliament. Currently, the negotiation process is moving slowly. Since September, the other side has been slowing down the process of negotiations due to its own internal elections. And after what may have been a miscalculation regarding Iran's internal developments, it cannot reach a conclusion. The text of the agreement is almost ready, according to the reports we have received. It is a joint decision by the Joint Commission of Iran and 4+1, based on which the U.S. can become a member of the P5+1 group again by fulfilling certain conditions. Currently, this agreement is the 4+1 group, and Iran's compensatory measures are based on this agreement, paragraph 26 of the JCPOA. But we took compensatory measures because the other party fulfilled its obligations. The original agreement is available, and it is the American side that, with the change of government, even though they confirmed the policy of maximum pressure failed, they will return to the agreement. Well, the Americans cannot return to the agreement without fulfilling their obligations, and this is the subject of negotiations for the past 1.5 years. The Americans resisted every step to lift any sanctions, and this has caused the negotiations to be prolonged. Otherwise, the Islamic Republic's position was the same in the beginning, and it's still the same, that if the Americans accept all their commitments, after we verify the sanctions have been lifted, Iran will return its compensatory measures to the level within the limits of the JCPOA. This is the negotiation process, but the other party has made political mistakes in the negotiating process. For instance, they kept waiting due to the elections and internal developments. Your audience knows that the internal situation is like in America, the extreme bipolarity that exists there, and they turn every issue into a political issue. This is not our concern as the opposing country, but it is the other side that has to solve its internal issues behind the door of the negotiating room, and after that, enter the negotiations. We face the obligations of the U.S. government, not the Democrats or the Republicans. But beyond this, it was an internal discussion, and perhaps they were facing a miscalculation with regard to Iran's internal developments. After September, there were protests in Iran after the death of Mrs. Amini, and the anti-Iranian groups must have tried to turn these protests into chaos and create disorder and disturbance in public security. Perhaps the Americans came to the analysis that Iran may desist from its main positions in the nuclear issue due to its own internal issues, but this was an incorrect calculation. We announced to the other party during those developments through the exchange of non-papers that we will not give up on our positions. These developments are the developments that the people themselves quickly helped to return public security to the country, and that happened. This year, we had one of the most glorious rallies on the 22nd of Bahman, the anniversary of the revolution, by the people, which was a clear international message that sovereignty in Iran, public security, and public order has the maximum support in Iran. At the same time, this slowness still exists on the other side, but Iran has not stopped on the issue of nuclear negotiations. With our president's trip to China, we have the suggestion of enhancing cooperation with China on the agenda. Finding new business partners is one of our priorities, while we demand the lifting of sanctions against our country. The issue of sanctions is not an issue that will stop Iran. The Parliament also requests reports from the authorities of our government at any level during the process of nuclear negotiations. It listens to their opinions, and if it has any opinion, it implements it. And in this framework, our main agenda is the Strategic Action Plan to lift sanctions.
Very good, Doctor. We had this very, how should I call it, this kind of strategic surprise for a lot of people in the world, the agreement that happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Contrary to the belief of many that this could never happen or that these two are never capable of coming to some sort of an agreement, of course, with the help of the Chinese government. Of course, this was done on the part of the National Security Council, and Dr. Shamkhani, who did that, which is a little bit different than if the foreign ministry had done that. Of course, the foreign organizations, security organizations, were involved in these discussions. But just in terms of the significance of this agreement, and also, once again, the Majlis's view and position on this agreement, if you could please give us a little insight and analysis, your analysis of how you see this agreement that has now happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
The parliament and the people's representatives pay a lot of attention to our relations with our neighbors. Some of the representatives are from the cities that are located in the borders of our neighboring countries. Therefore, they receive well the issue of strengthening relations with the neighbors, which is now one of the approaches and instructions of the government. In the case of Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Republic considers Saudi Arabia as an important country in the Islamic world, and our relationship with Saudi Arabia was not cut off by Iran, but it was Saudi Arabia that severed ties following some issues about the embassy and arguments before that. From the moment that some parties mediated, the Islamic Republic had announced that we are ready to restore bilateral ties with the Saudi government. But it was the other side that had some ambiguities and wanted to present conditions or to hear some issues in this regard. The Iraqi side, Mr. Al-Kadhimi government, entered as a mediator, and five rounds of security negotiations were held in Iraq with the presence of the deputy of the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Mr. Shamkhani's deputy, and also security negotiations were held in Muscat. And finally, with a change in the government, there was a little gap in the conclusion of these negotiations, and it was the Chinese side that followed up on this issue and tried to bring these negotiations to a conclusion. Well, we have friendly relations with China. We also welcome the principle of relations with Saudi Arabia. Of course, this does not mean that we do not have difference of opinion with Saudi Arabia. We have differences of opinion on some regional issues. But with due respect to the Saudi government, we have different opinions, but we do not consider it as a negation of bilateral relations. On the contrary, we think that we can raise these differences explicitly in bilateral relations and finally reach a common solution, Islamic world. In this way, negotiations were held with the mediation and suggestion of the Chinese side at a high level. And Mr. Shamkhani, in a five-day trip, met with his Saudi counterpart in Beijing, and they reached a document, and a statement was published that the two sides will move towards meeting with the foreign ministers as the ones who will follow up on this process and revive the activities of embassies in Tehran and Riyadh within a span of 2 months. Well, the initial steps have been taken. Our foreign ministers will meet soon, and after that, it seems that delegations will be exchanged. The discussion of reopening the embassies will probably be resumed soon. We consider this an achievement for the entire Islamic world because we think that the issues related to the Muslims could be brought up amongst each other. At the same time, we think that the interests of the Muslim people should be taken into consideration everywhere. China's role in this agreement was very important. China appeared as an influential actor in the West Asian region, where the Americans think they are the decisive player, and the reflection of China's role in this agreement within America in the American think tanks was extraordinary, and many considered it as America's weakness and its inability to create stability in the West Asian region and the Persian Gulf. Thus, China followed a relatively higher role than acting in these issues. But from the perspective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we think that expanding relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia can include the general interests of the Islamic world. The different issues that exist between us, from permanent religious cooperation, such as the issue of the Hajj, which is done naturally, to the development of cooperation at the economic level and the creation of a joint cooperation in the field of oil export, OPEC and OPEC Plus, are among the interesting topics that can be pursued. People's cooperation, such as consular relations, is an important topic that should be considered for the nationals of both sides. On the part of Saudi Arabia, I think different analyses were presented by the media and prominent personalities in steps for stability in the region with this move, and I believe that by continuing this path, we can reach the vision of a united Islamic front against the Zionists. The Zionists are the party that tries to sow the seeds of animosity in the Islamic countries in order for itself to survive, to create an opportunity in some Arab countries by creating a negative space for Iran or by harming the interests of Iran. They can put on a show. But the truth is that the Zionists are not accepted among the people of the region. Not only among the people of the region, but today they are also faced with a great internal challenge, which requires a plan to return them to the source of this oppression. That is, the occupation of a land that has original owners is the basis for the formation of this wrong existence, which ultimately has led to the formation of the Zionist regime, which we think is a false structure with weak foundations that will not last long.
Dr. Amri, we've come to the end of the program. We have maybe 1 or 2 minutes left. If there's anything else you need feel that you should mention about these issues, please go ahead. We have a few minutes.
Thank you for providing me with this opportunity. Politics in Iran has an active dynamism, which means that the parliament has serious discussions, opposes and approves, and the parliament, the government, and other forces have different opinions. Those who want to analyze and evaluate Iran must seriously consider this dynamic and the activity of different views inside Iran. At the same time, our effort in the governance of Iran is that this exchange of opinions and this exchange of views will lead to a single approach and strategy, which will ultimately be seen as Iran's foreign policy. Thank you.
Dr. Amri, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Amri? As the global order is changing, the world is entering a new era with new alliances being formed. And Iran is going to be dealing with a myriad of new opportunities and challenges. This requires the effective coordination of the different organizations tasked in Iran with conducting international relations, such as the Supreme National Security Council, the Foreign Ministry, the Security Services, and of course the Islamic Shura Majlis, which under the Constitution supervises the activities of the executive branch and without whose ratification no treaty or agreement is deemed legal under the law. As happened after the foolish U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, when the Majlis entered the scene and passed legislation to defend Iran's nuclear technology and industry in the face of Western noncompliance, so today the Majlis is warning the U.S. that Iran will not wait forever for the U.S. and Europe to make a decision about the ongoing sanctions relief and nuclear talks in Vienna. The Majlis is also seriously pursuing its constitutional duty as it relates to Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as BRICS Plus, as well as Iran's recent agreement with Saudi Arabia, and in general, all the supervisory and legislative aspects related to Iran's growing relations with its neighbors and regional and global partners. The Majlis is also finally getting serious about the de-dollarization of Iran's global trade, particularly after the dollar was used by Iran's enemies to cause economic destabilization after the failed color revolution of this year, and after repeated warnings by the leader of the Islamic Revolution to end the era of the dollar in the Iranian economy. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars
from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Soheil Sarani. Brother Soheil, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program Viewpoints in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. So for today's discussion, we are discussing the important topic of the book Nahjul Balagha, compiled by Sharif al-Ravi, or known as Sayyid al-Ravi. He was the one who collected and selected the most important sermons, or speeches, letters, and aphorisms or wise sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the book Nahjul Balagha. This book is considered as one of the greatest books in Islam after the Holy Quran, and unfortunately it's a pity that it's not given that much due attention even inside Islam, different interpretations and commentaries on this book. But Brother Ali, as the leader of Iran says, Ayatollah Khamenei, Nahjul Balagha is a help book for knowing more the religion of Islam. How we can know Islam more, or the true Islam more, through the book Nahjul Balagha?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. Thank you very much for this beautiful and important question, because it could be a good question even for those who are living in the West or those who are not very familiar or acquainted with Islamic knowledges and sciences, even abroad. And I mean, by abroad, I mean outside of the Islamic countries, and namely our country, Iran. For a person, definitely for a researcher, to know about Islam, I think the best thing is to refer to the real and basic sources of that issue of research. Brother, we cannot judge Islam by what has been said or has been written by others about Islam, or those who claim to be Orientalists or others cannot be a reliable search or reliable source for us. It is famous to be said that it is good to drink water from the headwaters.
That's right.
That is
from the fountain.
From the fountain.
That's right.
So a person who wants to have a good water, a very purified and beautiful water, he needs to go to the fountain or the headwater of the to take from the real and genuine source,
the pure water.
If a person wants to know about Islam, so what is the best source to know about it? Definitely the first and the foremost source is Al-Quran, and this is true. But the second, if I have not got enough knowledge, enough ma'rifa, enough ilm about what Islam is, so what is the second? Which book should I read? There are different variety of books written about Islam with different intentions, but those who are real researchers, I want to tell them, if they are familiar with the art of research, as a researcher, as a scholar, as a person who wants to delve into to an issue, it requires to refer to Quran and Nahjul Balagha, the peak of eloquence.
That's right.
Because when Quran has been revealed to the Holy Prophet, it was supposed to be interpreted by him and his household. Mm-hmm. And actually, Nahjul Balagha is a sequence or following book of Al-Quran. And also, in some sort of way, we can say that even it is a good commentary of Al-Quran and it the importance of it is to the importance, actually equals the importance of Al-Quran, because this is what the Holy Prophet does when he talks about two great heavy things, and he says, "Wallahu a'tarati, I leave among you two important heavy things. One is Al-Quran, and the other is my..." It means that they are the interpreters of the Quran. So if you want to know about, read Nahjul Balagha. Okay. If you want to read about if Quran, then read Nahjul Balagha. And Nahjul Balagha has been written or said, a collection of sayings and wisdoms and sermons and... And he is the first person who accepted Islam among the Muslims and embraced Islam. And then he became this religion at the dawn of Islam, right after the Holy Prophet. So comes to us is from this.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Ali. So it shows that the things in the Nahjul Balagha are really practical ones.
Very true.
That is of Imam Ali alayhi salam. I could remember there was one prophetic. He was invited to the city of Qom. I was his interpreter, the translator. His name was Dr. Munir Fahd. I was looking for a library, and all of a sudden, my account was Nahjul Balagha. So I picked it, and I opened it. The phrases that I wrote, I said, who is this man? Who is this man who wrote this? This is really close to the texture of the whole. I've seen something like that before. For me, it was really a shock that how the wording of Imam Ali alayhi salam similar to the hands and the fasaha and the balagha. That's right. Okay, Brother Sohail, let's...
Related to what you said, Shakib Arsalan,
okay?
Egyptian, when he was upon his literary works, the conference was that see only two important works in the history. One is Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. He got angry and stood up and said, are you comparing me to Ali alayhi salam? Who am I to be compared to Ali? In my literature or my writings, in complete is nothing.
Okay.
This is just...
And we should take care that Ali was a blatterist. He was an imam, okay? His words has divine rootings. And we can... the case sometimes of Islam among the blatterists is that they are comparing the text of Fathu Sajjadi and Nahjul Balagha to a meme of adabiyat or literature. But that was not part of the literature of Islam. But the case is that, and the context of this book is very much different. We can say novels, short novels or something like that. Or the
point. It's a very important point, actually.
Yes. Brother Sohail, what's your take on that?
Point that you mentioned about Imam Ali alayhi salam being leader, bilateralist. Oftentimes, like, you know, tend to limit certain things to a certain area. Nahjul Balagha, if you look at that book from just from the view, then it's limiting to it. But very rightly, Weber mentions in one of his speeches that it's not a wise man, for example, who is out of his rationality and cognition, his reckoning, which is not, it's not the work of or Arif, for example, the wayfarer. It's not the work of that spiritual being who is, projecting his inner thoughts and inner feelings, sermons and, speeches.
That's right.
It's not that. He's very well touched with the reality because he was the leader upon all the dimensions of humanities. He touched upon various aspects that human life faces. Okay, there is about war in Nahjul Balagha. There is about peace in Nahjul Balagha. Mm-hmm. There is about politics. There is about economy. There is about taqwa. There is about worshipping God. So there is about tawhid. There is about belief system.
That's right.
So it's a complete code of conduct. It's a very if you look at the book in that particular angle, then how Reber mentions is when you read Nahjul Balagha and when you comprehend that in a process, you get to know Imam Ali alayhi salam, and you get to know Islam.
That's all right.
Both at the same time because it's a complete Islam shanasi.
Yes. Islamic studies,
yeah. Islamology.
Islamology. Right. And then you know about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam as well, because Imam Ali alayhi salam lived his life based on Quran and Nahjul Balagha himself.
This is very important. This is very important, the important point that Brother Sohail says. When we get to the interpretation of the religion of Islam and the character of the Prophet Muhammad and Holy Quran, there are so many different sayings regarding this. And every person from his own aspect and angle has talked about Prophet Muhammad and the reality of Islam. But when you get to the text of Nahjul Balagha and through the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the very personality of his sayings, you want to know Islam, I think you have an authentic source. He was among the most important authentic Sahaba of Prophet Muhammad. He was the so many divine secrets blown into his spirit by Prophet Muhammad. Islam and the true Islam, I think, of fanaticism, fanatic and Islam because of Muhammad and because of the nature of Islam. But when you get to Nahjul Balagha and the very character of Imam Ali, how practical could a person be and be obedient to his master, that is Allah, Prophet Muhammad? Exactly. This is unfortunately what is missed in today's world, you know, where into the interpretation of it from the various scholars that live in our contemporary time.
You know, and, I would paraphrase that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that truth.
Mm-hmm. People of truth,
so
that's right.
There's the right methodology of knowing, you know, looking at Islam, that you need to know the truth, and then you will know who were on truth and who were those personalities. So you don't learn the things through the person, you know, the substance. And I very rightly mentioned, so see that... And again, I'm paraphrasing where our Holy Infallible Alayhi Salam says, if you press sayings and our teachings, then the beauty of them would make people follow us. You know, so that's very obvious. Like when to the world, and they will definitely, you know, Rehber also mentions in one of his speeches that those who are, those who are criticizing Islam or those who have some issue, and then each and everything about Islam.
That's true.
I would like to tell them, and he clearly mentioned that, you know, go and tell my words to them. Go and say them, tell this to them, those who are like, you know, in the reformation, you know, quote unquote, like they call
That's
it,
right.
call themselves as reformative camp or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Go between them and, you know, tell them that, you know, before doing this criticism, read once this book, Nahjul Balagha, and then see if you can criticize.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Sohail and Brother Ali Alavian, for your presence in the program Viewpoints, which was on the topic Nahjul Balagha, as discussed by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Dear listeners, visit our website at parstudio.com/Iran Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
يا نور الهلال أقبل تعال فالشوق طال والقلب سما نحو السماء مترنما لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian.
appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وعجبا أتكون الخلافة بالصحابة ولا تكون بالصحابة والقرابة
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, "How strange! Could the caliphate be through the Prophet's companionship, but not through his companionship and his kinship?"